A tremendous welcome to you all, everybody. I'm Claire Foster-Gilbert, the director of Westminster Abbey Institute, and this is the last in our series on healing. We've looked at healing society, healing the planet, healing ourselves, the role of ethical leadership in international healing, and today we're going to see how we might harness technology, that all-pervasive thing that we cannot get ourselves away from, that seems to be capable of so much good and also so much harm. I should just say we're in Cheney Gates, which is a medieval room from which the boys in the tower were taken. Is that right?
Nearly.
My lovely colleagues.
Nearly.
Elizabeth. Oh, thank you.
Richard, Duke of York, who's the younger brother of King Edward. His mother,
Elizabeth Woodville,
was persuaded to give him up, and he went from here to the tower, and he didn't emerge.
So she sought sanctuary here, and this really unethical thing then happened. And we're going to talk about ethics. So Westminster Abbey Institute was set up to explore ethics and underlying morality and spirituality in public life and seeks to promote public service. So the tenor of our conversation is not going to be combative. It's going to really see how we can harness this tremendous force that we have for the good. And our august speakers are going to help us do that. I'll introduce each of them first, and then each of them will speak for 10 minutes. There'll be a bit of conversation between the three of them, and then we'll open the discussion to the floor, so do have your questions ready, and we will finish promptly at 2 p.m. Thank you all very much for coming. So Chi Onwuara is the Labour MP for Newcastle Central, and your biographers will show you just how much of a background in this world she has and how competent she is to speak about the issue. Rory Kethlen-Jones is the former BBC technology correspondent, still active writing. His book is on sale and he says he'll sign copies if you want to buy a copy on the way out. And Michael Burdett is a theological philosopher. Did I get that right?
Philosophical theologian.
So sorry.
That's all right.
Philosophical theologian. The distinction is different. Who has also thought a great deal about these issues. And I do commend the Ethical Investment Advisory Group of the Church of England, whom he advises, has recently published a report on the policies it's developed and the principles it's developed to guide its investment in technology companies. It's a really, really thoughtful report for anybody who wants to understand better this world and also think about it philosophically, theologically, ethically. So, Chi, can we begin with you, please? Would you mind standing up to speak just a
second? Sure. Sure, yes. That's what I'm accustomed to do in the House of Commons. And please do shout order after 10 minutes, because I could talk about this forever, literally, and I'm not going to. So I'm Chi Onwuara, I'm the MP for Newcastle Central, and it's a great pleasure to be invited here. It's a wonderful and historical room, and I was intrigued by this discussion and this debate. And I want to sort of start off by saying that I consider myself a tech evangelist. Now, I worked as an engineer in the tech sector for over 20 years before coming into Parliament. I have a degree in electrical engineering, and I always say that I went into Parliament for exactly the same reasons I went into engineering some decades earlier, and that is to make the world work better for everyone, and that is both ethically as well as practically and pragmatically. But I've also found it deeply disturbing to follow the trajectory of tech as I've practiced it from boring, you know, back in the 90s, if I wanted to stop a party in full flow, they just announced that I was an engineer, you know, so boring but incredibly useful, to exciting but incredibly exploitative. And I have been dismayed almost from the day of my election by the lack of robust scrutiny of the role and implications of technology in our lives and the lack of an appropriate forward-looking 21st century legislative framework which critically reflects technology's potential for harm as well as good and also that the impact of technology on society is a choice, and generally a political choice. Technology should not be something that is done to people. You know, technology, without their say or consent, technology is something that should empower people, enable people, free people, you know, to make their own choices. And I have called, and I am a Labour politician, but this is the absence of government action in this space almost criminally negligent, you know, and I repeatedly call for greater clarity over critical questions like the responsibility of tech giants who control the data that the data trail that we leave. Now, I'm a shadow minister for science and as a research and innovation, and as a tech evangelist, I clearly do believe that technology possesses significant healing potential. And I'm proud to be a part of Labour's new industrial strategy and two of its four missions relating to tech policy for healing purposes. You know, one of them, so caring for the future, that's one of our industrial strategy missions, which sets standards for innovation and technology in care, capitalising on the opportunity presented by our unified data health system and world-leading research base that we have. And the other is specifically called Data for the Public Good. So that's about harnessing data for the public good, using the new capabilities of data analytics and artificial intelligence to deliver better public services and improve people's quality of life. And if we can actively shape these technologies for the public good, they can have the potential to greatly improve productivity and public services like the NHS, and also as a consequence, people's lives and people's people's time for themselves and engagement with others and themselves, as well as the state's ability to heal and support people. But this can only be realised if everyone is empowered to take advantage of technology, with no one left behind. And so the first issue I would raise is digital divide, both in terms of who uses technology, but actually critically in terms of who creates it. So just 4% of the tech workers and fewer than 1% of STEM professors are Black, Asian, or minority ethnic. And so as long as technology is restricted, the creators of technology are restricted to a narrow demographic, then technology does not reflect humanity, and by consequence, it cannot be humane. And if it's not humane, it can't realize its full potential for healing. So we miss out on fantastic technologies that we could be developing with so much power for transformation if we were capitalizing on everybody's abilities. So that's one thing. Let me just talk a little bit about algorithms, which are the big kind of thing. Interesting. Algorithms, again, are only as good as their design and the data they are trained on. They're designed by software engineers who, as I said, come from quite a narrow class of people. And they are generally trained, or they have been, I think hopefully things are changing, trained on quite narrow data sets. So, for example, there was a very famous example of the algorithm which identified Black people as gorillas because the facial recognition had only been trained on white faces. And the thing I want to emphasize is that these are an integral part of our lives, but without any appropriate regulation. We don't see or hear about all the algorithms which are driving or making decisions about us, but there isn't a regulatory framework. And I want to talk also about digital labour relations, so over the last few years we've seen the rise of businesses which I call sexy term, but it's the new intermediaries. So they're platforms and they act as intermediaries between us and the services that we are looking to use. So an Uber is the service is a taxi service, so they claim to be a tech company, but an Uber driver isn't classed as an employee by the company and have less, don't get sick pay or training or any of the rights that you might expect. And so again, you know, that's a tech, that's a choice as to how those technologies, the algorithms, are implemented. And it could liberate drivers to be able to choose from a wide range of potential customers or potential platforms, but instead it tends to control people. And sort of my final example is just in terms of how technology can be healing or exploitative is from it's actually from Manchester, a tech startup called Digital Recent Digital, and it's from a not fully talked about sector, which is sex work. And they, a company called Reason Digital, were developing an app to help keep sex workers safe. Now, the nature of sex work and the locations in which they find means that sex workers are often vulnerable to crimes, and they've been difficult to solve because of the reluctance of them and their clients to come forward. And the crime scenes are often public and subject to interference. So Digital wanted to keep sex workers safe by letting them know of all the other incidents of crime, of attacks on sex workers in their areas. Now, there was a choice in how that app worked. So it could have tracked all the sex workers, kept all that information in a database, and let each of them know if there was a crime. But none of them would have taken that app because they would have been being tracked and they would have been subject to surveillance and also to threats. What they did instead was have an app which had a distributed infrastructure, so no, there was no central knowledge of where everyone was, but every sex worker's phone was alerted by other phones when there was an incident in nearby. And I use that particular example to illustrate that that was a technology choice around architecture, which sounds quite complicated and geeky, if you like. But the consequences were very real, both in terms of the effectiveness of the app and, if you like, the humanity of the app. And so the key message I want to sort of leave you with, as well as the fact that obviously, you know, a Labour government would introduce a forward-looking, freeing and enabling regulatory framework. But the key message I want to look at is that whether technology heals or divides, and, you know, I've even talked about misinformation, the architecture of Twitter versus the architecture of other apps. That is always a choice. It's a choice which may be made implicitly by software engineers or data scientists, but it's a choice which is made explicitly by the government of the day in terms of what is the regulatory framework in which these applications grow and are taken and are used, and also what are the access to skills and to a certain extent to income that those who are using that. And I want to see technology as something that everybody feels that they are part of creating, not something which too many of my constituents feel now, which is something that is imposed upon them in which they seek to escape.
Rory, are you happy to stand?
I'm happy to stand. This is slightly scary, but luckily I have made use of a fabulous piece of technology I've got with me. I've got this microcomputer with me. I don't know if anyone has got one of these. It's got a timer on it, and it's going to go off after 10 minutes, after which I will shut up. As a daily news journalist for 40 years, I'm now a recovering BBC technology correspondent. I have to confess, it was rare for me to sit back and think about the deeper significance of the stories that I was involved in, the technology I was covering, as we're being invited to do today. At the forefront of my thinking every single day was one very simple question. Can I flog this to my editor? Can I get on the 10 o'clock news, elbowing aside the political editor, the Europe editor, the Middle East correspondent, the employment correspondent, and everybody else, and demand my 2 minutes of airtime? That was my sole focus. But then in the space of a year or so, I began to think differently. A whole lot of things happened to change my thinking about technology and my job. I got a Parkinson's diagnosis, which I broadcast shared via Twitter. And that was an extremely powerful moment because it showed me a lot of the positive sides of social media. I got a fantastic response, a lot of support. There was one person who said, you've been standing too close to too many 5G masts, but but we'll move on from that. At the same time, I got a book contract and wondered how I would fit that round my busy work schedule. And the book contract encouraged me to think deeply about the era which I'd covered, which loosely defines the smartphone era. And then COVID came along, which had its pluses as well as its minuses. It forced me to retreat from the newsroom to my attic and focus and get on with the book while doing my day job. And it made me a little bit more reflective about tech and what it was doing to us. I was trying to put into context the period from 2007 to 2021. The smartphone era. The smartphone era began when Steve Jobs stepped onto a stage in January 2007, and I was there in the room, and it was an incredibly impressive performance, and unveiled this device, which wasn't the first smartphone, but was the one which introduced us to this idea that we could use these tiny computers for all sorts of things besides talking, and that they would change our lives in so many ways. And as I looked back over that era, I realised there was a kind of arc of hope and despair as we first wondered at the potential of these new toys and then recoiled at the harm which they threatened. So the hope stage, let's start with that. The sheer excitement, I mean, I still get excited about technology, but the sheer wonder of seeing what a smartphone could do, what a voice-controlled speaker could do. The first time I said, Echo, tell me what the weather's like, something completely bland, and it replied, it was kind of, wow, how does that work? And it's very easy to lose that sense of wonder. We rapidly do. We say, but it didn't understand me, it's rubbish. And that's the weather for New York, not York, Yorkshire. We lose that wonder very quickly. But it was an incredible time. The combination of these devices, these miraculous devices, with these very powerful social networks. And for a while, it seemed to be almost universally positive. It changed the balance of power, the balance between chief executive and worker, mainstream media and citizen journalist, celeb and fan, president and people, at least that was the theory. The Arab Spring seemed to vindicate that theory of how democratizing this force was. We all saw what happened on the streets of Cairo, people holding up banners saying Facebook. We were brought into that. And the high point was probably the 2012 London Olympics, where, I don't know if you remember, Tim Berners-Lee sat there and sent a tweet round saying, this is for everyone. And that seemed to sum up what the technology was. I particularly liked the fact that the American commentator said, who is this guy? And one of them said to the other, oh, let's Google him, and not realising that they wouldn't have been able to have Google but for Tim Berners-Lee. That was the high point, and then it's been really downhill since there. And a lot of it, I mean, what we realised that the balance of power hadn't really shifted. New malign powers were unleashed, from cyber gangs to rogue states, to trolls, to abusers, to, God help us, Elon Musk. And we began to focus on Myanmar and what happened there, rather than the Arab Spring, where Facebook was an incredibly powerful force, liberating those who wanted to cause harm to a minority. And I saw this mostly through Tim Berners-Lee, who I interviewed time and again, and he went from incredible optimism to great pessimism in 2019, 30 years after he launched the document that began the web, he had realised what a malign force he'd unleashed. He used to say, it doesn't matter, all these sort of trolls and abusers and purveyors of misinformation, because everybody I mix with on the internet is great, there are other engineers, and just ignore the rest of it. And then he said, I came to a realisation about those trolls, abusers, misinformation spreaders, those people vote, and therefore they can do bad things to me. But in the book I wrote, I came to a kind of a synthesis of this hope and fear and despair, with a final section about healing. Because when the pandemic came along, as I was writing this book, it seemed to show both the good and the bad. The good, FaceTime enabled me to speak to my 1-year-old granddaughter every day, a few miles away, but unable to see her otherwise. The bad, it spread nonsense about vaccines and 5G. And I also began to quite literally see the possibilities of technology for healing, because I began to write about health, about my own health, and about the, at that stage, unfulfilled promise of the technology to do more, less trivial things than simple social media posts, to use these devices to monitor conditions remotely. I'm writing a lot about the use of wearable technology to treat Parkinson's. I'm actually wearing a device right now, which is an experimental device which sends a current through me and may or may not work. But I'll let you know in a few weeks' time. Subscribe to my newsletter. So there are all sorts of raging debates about technology's impact on health. I retain my optimism. I mean, one particular area I'm really interested in is the debate, and it's a fascinating ethical debate about the sharing of our health data. I'm passionately in favour, as someone with two long-term conditions, that we should all, just as people agree to give their organs, we should all agree to share our health data. And the debate has been very much coloured over the last 10 years by privacy concerns, which are obviously important. But the other side of the equation, which is the benefit that can come from sharing data, is never really seen. There was a whole new scheme going to be launched a year or so back where GP data, which is incredibly important, would be shared. And the headline in The Guardian was, NHS in new data grab, which was not a positive way to look at it. So I retain my excitement about technology. I hear everything that people say about, for instance, the dangers of AI. I think we have woken up. The good thing is that whereas we built the social networks, enthused about them, and then discovered how dangerous they would be, this time with AI, we are having the debate early. Somebody said to me the other day, there are more AI ethics institutes than AI institutes. and we may build a constituency around the idea of technology as a healing rather than a harming force. Thank you.
Michael.
Great, thank you so much for the invitation to come in and speak with all of you today on such an auspicious occasion. I'm certain the other distinguished panel members agree with me that the issue of healing is as important today in our society than it has ever been. And I was very pleased to see that technology was just one of the issues to be considered in relation to into this very topic. Well, I am the token theologian here. And it sometimes feels as though I am the interloper in these kinds of conversations around kind of technology. can they shoehorn me in? See, people ask, well, what are you doing here? But I'm sure the setting here in the Abbey actually bespeaks how the Christian church, and indeed all faiths or none, as we're increasingly seeing, have some role to play in speaking both about healing, individual and corporate, and the role that technology might play in it. Putting healing and technology together likely invites, on the face of things, discussion of medical technology, as we've been hearing here already, and its role in transforming physical well-being. I'm sure I don't need to tell you that Christian theologians had a large voice in developing initial bioethical discourse, of which medicine is a part, in the early years of its development in the 1960s, with figures such as Paul Ramsey, Joseph Fletcher, and Richard McCormick. One can hope that just as the church had and continues to have a role in laying the foundation for good principles and associated action in bioethics, it will continue to have an active role in developing the ethical and indeed public development of all technology and its impact on all of us. As we have already heard, and perhaps more pressingly have experienced for ourselves, technology is shaping just about every area of human life. So considering that impact is as vital today as it has ever been, and this is one of the reasons why I myself devote so much time to it in my everyday work as an academic and a theologian who also was an engineer for about 4 to 5 years in Space Park in Southern California. So to shape my thoughts here in our brief time together, I thought I would focus my attention on the framework and principles of a recent report that Claire spoke about earlier on big tech, written by the Ethical Investment Advisory Group of the Church of England, of which I was a part and contributed my services. In fact, one of the esteemed authors of it is here, Nathan Mladen. If I had one thing to say to you here that I hope you might take away, it is this. We fail ourselves, our society, and those we serve if the only consideration we give to technology and its development is one that just seeks to prevent harm and mitigate risks so as to maintain a good public image. Certainly negative ethics, i.e. the prevention of harm, is the lowest bar with any technological ethic, but it should not be the core of our comportment. Rather, in the spirit of thinking technology in terms of healing, we need to be thinking about not just preventing getting hurt, which is of course necessary for healing, but also how to promote flourishing, the flourishing of each individual. What does it mean to be healed, but to promote flourishing and to live well? We need to actively promote what is called positive ethics here. And the EIAG report provides 5 principles in tech ethics that are motivated by specifically Christian commitments around this issue of human flourishing that I fully endorse, though I think you'll see that they are hardly partisan by any stretch. So let me allow me some time to kind of unpack these 5 different principles. First, we are called to flourish as persons and to enable others to do so. We can understand the meaning of human flourishing by giving examples of its absence. Poverty, for example, implies a lack of flourishing, as does being enslaved or oppressed. Second, we are called to flourish in relationship. The biblical vision of shalom, peace, is a profoundly relational one in which nothing and no one exists by and of themselves, but only in relationship to others. We are only as good as those we are in relationship with. Flourishing in community is the flip side of flourishing as persons. We are created not as individuals, but as persons for each other. Third, we are called to stand with the marginalized. Jesus Christ declares that he has come to bring good news to the poor, release to the captives, and freedom to the oppressed. There is a constant refrain throughout the scripture that God cares for the smallest, the weak, and the least powerful. Fourth, we are called to care for creation. There is a sense throughout much of scripture that the natural world is not just inert matter, but is capable of praising God. This suggests that it is not only to be treated well because it is in the human interest to do so, but that it is to be beloved and cherished for its own sake. And then finally, we are called to serve the common good. All of the different dimensions of peace, shalom, are encompassed within a holistic condition of peace and justice that is shared by all. It is a vision of the good that is held in common by all, from which all benefit and which to all contribute. It is a universal vision of the good in which not only human beings participate, but also all of creation, all of nature, everything, and all of reality. The idea of the common good, an idea that is opposed to both individualism and collectivism, captures, I think, in some sense, this idea of the common good. Now, informed by these five theological principles, the EIAG identified four distinct challenges to the tech industry that might encourage companies to reflect on the impacts of the technologies that they develop, to have robust policies and procedures which allow them to act on these reflective insights and explain how the design and outcomes of their technologies have been controlled in a way that is consistent with these following commitments. So we invited companies to demonstrate these five things. A commitment to verifiable transparency. From a user perspective, policies, terms and conditions, and consent processes should be clear, concise, and easy to find. Enhanced information related to impacts on users and society should be provided. Where possible, data on actual or potential impacts of new technologies on society should be made available. These companies should also demonstrate a commitment to human-centered design. Of course, safety and fairness for users should be prioritized, particularly in relation to algorithmic processes and outcomes. Ethical considerations, including the risk of adverse impacts on users and society, should be incorporated into any company governance and risk management process. Users should have a choice over how algorithms and persuasive technologies impact their online experiences. For example, they should be able to turn off algorithms that curate their content feeds, provide recommendations or social nudges. They should be able to switch off personalized advertising and choose alternative recommendation systems. Users should know how their data is collected, what it is being used for, how it is aggregated and/or anonymized, and also how it is altered. Users should be able to exercise data rights, such as the removal of personal data and portability between platforms. We also call upon companies to demonstrate a commitment to enable the flourishing of children and the vulnerable. Children and other vulnerable groups deserve enhanced protections. For example, in relation to social media, age verification, profiling by both advertising and algorithmic systems, nudges, addiction, of course, and harmful content. And fourth and finally, we think that tech companies should show a commitment to foster a flourishing and well-governed tech ecosystem for the benefit of the common good. They should establish boards' responsibility for the ethical and social impacts of their businesses, particularly data and algorithmic systems. Now, these principles and commitments should motivate all areas of design, creation, and deployment of technology, and regular audits and independent oversight boards created that are drawn from across a diverse spectrum of peoples within our society to ensure not only compliance, but that these principles are genuinely motivating the design, the creation, and the deployment of it, and promoting the flourishing of all peoples, and indeed all of creation. Of course, much more could be said here, but I think these principles and commitments are a good place to begin when thinking about how technology might contribute to healing and our common flourishing together. Thank you for the time, and I look forward to the discussion.
What commendable timekeeping, and how we used our tech to support that. Thank you very much. Can I just now ask our our panel to consider this question, which has occurred to me, which is, knowing what human nature is like, how hopeful are you that we will, as a human family, be able to harness this extraordinary technology with the maturer understanding that Rory has identified, and indeed in the ways in which Michael has so clearly put and she hopes for from the legislature? How hopeful are you that we're actually, even if we're willing to work with work with technology, even if we're willing to do it in a morally mature way, are we able to?
I'm instinctively and naturally a hopeful politician. That's right. Probably why I'm a Labour politician, and I am hopeful of people's desire, if you like, for self fulfilment and for to improve their and others' lives. But I'd also say that I do believe, you know, fundamentally, that it is possible, and I find it very the tech companies or the different governments of different countries who say that it's not possible, either because technology is so amazing and so goes so. I mean, as I always say, this is not rocket science, and literally, and all the technology that we are using and the fantastic technology that we are, you know, that we are using is codified and, you know, and understood. It is present now. It's not, we don't know what's going to happen in 5 or 10 years, but this is technologies now, and it's being used. It's got a huge potential, and the sort of the kind of technology that can tell me, you know, that I need to buy a new pair of sandals before I've even begun thinking about my summer holidays, as it were, is the sort of technology that can sort of manage and improve itself for the public good. So I think that it is possible. I think that governments and civil society have to believe that. I don't think it's easy to put in place the right regulatory framework, if you like. I think there are very difficult choices about privacy versus public good, freedom of speech versus protection for the vulnerable. There are challenges that we need to talk about as a society, and that's a British society, if you like, or it's also a global society, because some of these challenges cannot be addressed on a purely country by country basis. Or for example, if you see what is happening in China with how the internet is, or the web is being used there as an agent of surveillance, and not rather than an agent of personal liberation, then there are great challenges, but I believe fundamentally that if we are clever enough to invent this technology, we are clever enough to use it for the human good.
Yes, but will we?
Oh, your question was, possible?
To be clear. It's the, you think, well, I really want to do the good thing, the right thing, but actually I'm not morally strong enough to. But I'm afraid I'm not going to let you say any more, because I want to hear from Rory and Michael.
Yeah, I mean, I think there'll be waves of, you know, destruction and then creation, as it were. I mean, one of the problems is that innovation, maybe sadly, does not usually come from people who sit down and think, how can I construct an ethical product that causes no harm to anyone? In the classic line, they move fast and break things. We, the public, the politicians, the regulators, are always a few steps behind, often being told by... I thought it was interesting, though, sort of a decade ago, the Silicon Valley kind of truism was that the internet is a different place. It is somewhere, there's a John Perry Barlow quote, I think, about don't bring your earthbound laws to our wonderful free internet space. And that was, you know, good, well-meaning internet apostles trotted out this. And, of course, it was nonsense because the Chinese government then proved that the internet was not an uncontrollable place. And we gradually began, and we're still doing this, began to feel our way towards some form of regulation. And that's proving to be very difficult, proving to get the balance. We're seeing in the whole debate about the online safety bill at the moment, the balance between the different sort of ethical considerations that Michael talked about is not a simple matter. But I think we'll continue, you know, there's not going to be an end point where suddenly we have got ethical technology. Each new wave will come along and people will do bad things. The bad things will make them very rich, and then the regulation will come in and we will hopefully get to a better place. But the battle, I don't think, will ever be won.
Thank you. Michael?
Yeah, I think there's a particular challenge with the current state that we're in with technological development because of the way it is so global. These tech companies aren't localized to a particular country, but if they don't like certain kind of regulatory frameworks in one, they'll just go somewhere else. And so it's going to be a more difficult issue to contend with because of China might have very different regulatory frameworks around how this might work. And what happens if they get a hold of our data over here and I go to China? Do they have some kind of, you know, social credit system on me? So it's what I want to say, things are a lot more tenuous and vulnerable than they've always been, which doesn't mean to say that it can't happen. I mean, look at what happened with nuclear technology and things like that. You know, I mean, there hasn't been a release of a nuclear bomb in, you know, at least, what, 50 to 67 years. But I mean, it's at any point a lot more tragic things could happen. So I am hopeful, but a lot more can go wrong much more quickly.
Thank you. So if you could, your questions could be mildly clearer than mine was, I'd be grateful. I'll take three at a time. Put your hands right up, and we will. So first here, please, another one.
Anybody else? Okay. Shall I go ahead? I'm John Wood, a retired academic scientist stroke engineer. I've worked for the last 20 years plus on large international research infrastructures, including data, but I'm a consultant at CERN on new innovation. And one thing we work at CERN, one of our principles is to work for peace. And that was why it was set up 60 years ago. And there was a program called Science for Peace. And I took a bunch of theological philosophers, or whichever way round it is, there to discuss some of the issues. And trying to engage with people in this debate. We're not sitting in our little nerdy groups. We want to discuss these things. And I call the Large Hadron Collider the Large Human Collider, because it brings people from all around the world to talk, share. And I don't think we hear enough about how we can use science for peace in the both in the political and in the theological debate. I was just thinking here too, I'm in touch with a student, an English student in California at Caltech. Day one, first week, first term, ethics of AI was the course, and she's a physicist. I just wonder how we can use education both, sorry, I'm going on a bit. When I look at university courses in this country, there's nothing that engages that way. It may be different now. Sorry.
Thank you very much.
That's not a long question.
It would be good to hear a couple more if there are any. Yes, sister? Thank you.
Margaret Wong. I'm a Franciscan sister. I'm in education all my life. I would just like to follow up from what he said. I suppose I'm very deeply concerned. I didn't grow up with all this technology. I'm past that age. But toddlers today grow up. What is our government or God knows doing about it? That is very scary for me.
Thank you. And a third. Yes, Jamie, thank you.
I'm Jamie Hawke. I chair the Institute. I wanted to ask a question about echo chambers and how you think we might get a broader sense of exploding some of these echo chambers, which do such extraordinary harm to our ability to think more generally.
Thank you. So who wants to start?
Can I start on echo chambers? I think we should obviously put some blame on the networks and the way their algorithms work and the way they drive people, they reward extreme positions. But I think we should also start learning ourselves a disciplined way of handling this technology. I'm probably as guilty as most of living in an echo chamber, but I, for instance, have been on Twitter for 15 years and now follow nearly 7,000 people. So there's a huge tidal wave of stuff coming at me. And I had a job in the 2010 general election as digital election correspondent when Twitter was just starting to invade Parliament. And I sadly made it made a decision to follow every single political Twitter account I could find, which I'm now burdened with all these years later. But it does mean that I do get a broad view. And I think we all need to ask ourselves, what is the information flow I'm serving myself? Am I opening myself to a variety of views? Because it is in your own hands.
And anything about education and also the exposure of the very young?
Well, I've done quite a lot about, and to be honest, I now feel slightly guilty, scare stories about technology and children. We all know that every time a new technology comes along, the cry goes up, but think of the children. When I was growing up, it was television. Why don't you go outside and do something more useful instead? The technology is both that we're exposing our kids to now is both much more interesting and absorbing and useful and interactive than sitting in front of the telly, and it's also more dangerous. It's far more creative, you know. Young people ask me about getting into journalism these days, and I say, well, 40 years ago, I couldn't have my own television channel, my own newspaper, my own whatever, and now I can, and that offers huge possibilities. And yes, we all know the dangers that lurk out there. And again, it's about learning and understanding the technology, seeing its dangers, but also seeing its possibilities as parents.
Michael.
As an educator myself, seeing students come through, one of the things that, gosh, you've certainly seen in the news, but the whole idea of the death of the expert. I see this at the very forefront with students of just kind of saying, what is a credible source? You know, somebody who just happens to have a blog somewhere, you know, is not something you can cite in an academic paper, you know. And so this absolutely has to kind of happen. It has to be digital proficiency, but then also having a deep and abiding respect that presumably something on the BBC will have greater credit, you know, than something which might come from Breitbart, you know. So absolutely education has some kind of role to play, but also recognizing the flip side of the echo chamber is also the democratization then of the media allows precisely for something more specified, that you can have a podcast on platform economics because it's allowed this kind of proliferation. So it is the flip side of something which is positive as well.
Gee.
I think on the echo chamber question, and I think one of the most destructive actually approaches that we had with the internet and sort of the earlier years was that phrase, don't feed the trolls. And this was when, you know, when there was very negative attacks or whatever on Twitter, was the idea that you, or Twitter or Facebook, whatever, you didn't engage with it. They were the trolls, you didn't feed them. And I think that left the a lot of the social media space to the wrong people. it was advice that was given to people in the public eye, sort of like me, do not respond, etc. And I think we should have, and this again, we should have seen the social media or space as a space where all voices needed to be heard and supported and protected. And I think the issue is, we can't actually control what we see until we have the visibility of the algorithms that that Michael was talking about. I mean, I met with the Jewish Leadership Council and the Anti-Semitism Policy Trust last week to talk about that they've studied the way in which just some semi-normal posts, if you like, will step by step take you to rampant anti-Semitism, and not through your own control, but just because the algorithm drives more, eye time. It's fed by eye time, not fed by actually what your interests are so much. So that's the but.
Sorry, Chi, what's eye time?
Well, how long your eyes stay because you can see your eyes stay in contact with the screen. So if you see a post which is telling you something awful, you're more likely to spend more time looking at it than if you see a post saying, what a wonderful world.
But isn't that just a magnification of what's been the truth in popular media for decades? What bleeds leads, as it were.
That's a really good point. It is, but the issue here is that it's not a magnification, actually. I would say it was an industrialization. And it is, like with the Industrial Revolution, that makes all the difference. The fact that it is industrialized makes it much more effective, much more productive, depending on how you're measuring what you're measuring in productivity, but it also makes it much more powerful. In terms of, I've got a constituent in Newcastle, a young gay woman who was in contact with a Russian gay girl as well, through social media, in exchanging their life experiences. So it can open it up, but I do think that you need to have the regulatory framework we were talking about to support that, to support opening up the echo chamber, as well as the individual choices. So I try and I follow some conservative politicians as well. But just briefly, just to talk about ethics, because this is a big issue for me. I've been working with the Royal Academy of Engineering and the Engineering Policy Council, and I think that most engineering courses now, they do include ethics. They do include a look at the ethical, engineers have an ethical responsibility, which wasn't part of the kind of Silicon Valley libertarian approach to technology engineering. So there is an ethical dimension to it. And I understand that, as well as AI ethics centers, AI ethics consultants is one of the biggest growing and best paid sort of professions. So I'm sure that will...
do ask your questions. What strikes me about this conversation, about this whole area, is it's so human. What we're talking about here is human nature just intensified. Industrially intensified, which makes it both for the better and for the worse. But so you, just in case you're holding back because you think, I don't know anything about tech, which I certainly don't, please do ask your questions about, for example, how are we preparing our children, how are we preparing their core strength to choose not to let their attention be pulled one way or another? How are we looking after ourselves, let alone regulating the tech? Anthony, then you. Good, that's got a few more.
Hi, I'm Anthony Ball, working here at the Abbey, and it's that question of choice, Claire, that I was wanted to ask about. If we're going to allow technology to be for everybody, so all the people not excluded, as you were pointing out, Chi, what about the people who choose not to engage with it? I'm not on Twitter or Facebook or anything like that, and which is slightly strange. But if you choose, can we rely on everybody else to make sure there's a decent environment, even if I choose not to engage, or do I have to choose to engage in order for my kids to be able, or kids
singular. Wait, we're going to have the other two, because we have to watch the time.
Thank you. I'm Reverend Dan Vanka. I'm the chaplain to the school, so I spend a lot of time, Westminster School. So I spend a lot of time, well, it is that to me, it's anyway. I think a lot about identity, and particularly alongside these young people, a lot about their identity. And it seems that there's an assumption around the use of a term such as ethics, that it's somehow a known, understood term, that we're saying goodness, good people, the good, and we all have the same sort of tell us the same end in mind, and I don't think we do. So I think it's worth clarifying that when we're talking about this, we're talking about something that is framed in different schools of thought. And I wonder, there's a constant batting between what is a utilitarian version and a virtue version. We're saying that we want people to become somebody virtuistically, and yet we're talking in technological terms and in algorithms that function broadly, and I suggest only, in a utility. So they're looking to gain and get something at the maximum. Could you speak something about formation of character in an environment in which the only good is more?
Thank you. Very good.
The only good is more.
Christopher, briefly, if you would.
The obligatory lay person, Christopher Dawes. We've had some references to regulation and to government, but the hard fact is that regulators are a step away from the people who are actually doing anything. And every day we open our newspapers and see yet another complete breakdown in regulation right across the piece. Yesterday it was river pollution. Previously it's been outpourings into the oceans. The regulators are human and they just can't do the job. And as for government, well. So I'm deeply in sympathy with Michael, and I think that it's the thing that is going to work is the moral and ethical framework within which we all live. And it's quite clear that if we all loved our neighbours as us...
I'm so sorry, I have to speed you up because we're running out of time.
Well, it's quite clear if we loved our neighbours as ourselves, we would be a lot further advanced.
Thank you. Very good. So I'm afraid I must ask each of our speakers to say something in response, and these will be the last things that you say. So who wants to go first?
Rory. I'm trying to remember what I was about to leap in and say.
Oh, so sorry. This was...
Choose not to engage.
The people who choose not to engage.
Choosing not to engage. I often get asked this in relation to, you know, government services going online. It's the same as, you know, bank branches closing. It is restricting services to a certain constituency, which is by far the biggest constituency, and we do have to be careful about that. But I would say that it's very difficult as a parent not to at least get in the water and find out whether it's cold or hot. So I do think we have obligations as parents unless we are going to go down the unrealistic route of banning our children from swimming in those pools. We need to swim in them ourselves.
Thank you. Chi.
So I think you can choose not to engage, but there will be consequences. And I think if you are concerned about your fellow humans, you know, then choosing not to engage is leaving an important current and very important current battlefield. I'd say that, you know, the only good is not more, and that is part of what government is about establishing, I would say. And I think to say that, you know, regulators who have had their funding cut and have been eviscerated in terms of skills and resources, and now then it's not enough regulation, is to sort of buy into the idea that the state can't do anything about this. And so I'll just finish by quoting Martin Luther King, who said, you know, that the state can't make my brother like me, but he can stop him from lynching me, and I find that's quite helpful.
Yeah. Michael.
Yes, of course. Well, somebody who has two very young children, a two-year-old and a four-year-old, I can tell you when certainly the four-year-old comes home from school, the greatest battle is, please, can I use your iPad? And even though you set up any amount of rules around what this is going to be and wanting to know what kind of things they're kind of doing, it says something that the tech leaders, whenever you ask them what you do with your children, say, whoa, I don't give them anything whatsoever, which I think they then recognize that personally, that personal formative, moral formative kind of components and just how important that is, certainly for young people, but let's be honest, even after the age of 18, how important it is that our technological habits are shaping who we are and creating us to be certain kinds of citizens. And this has absolute relevance to our societies, to our politics, to our very spirituality. So it goes very deep. And I share a bit of, I think, your concern as well that we go to utilitarianism because it's easier to code, consequentialism because this is easier. But there are other people. There's a chap at Oxford Brookes University. He's doing a lot on what would it mean if we were to use virtue ethics to actually organize and develop, you know, autonomous systems, things like this. More robust character first interpretation of how might this change what we do with the kind of technology. But we need to be speaking a lot more about things in those terms. Who are we becoming?
Well, thank you very much, Michael, Rory, Chi, for a fantastic contribution. Thank you all for your questions, for your attention, for your interest. Isn't this an incredibly important area of all our lives? And can we hear what Chi says when she says, don't leave this territory to the baddies? We do need to engage with this. We really, really do. So this is the end of the autumn program on healing. You are witness to it. Do please make sure you're on our mailing list so you know about the exciting things that are going to happen next year, when we're delighted that we're going to have a deputy director and there will be more to do and say in different sorts of ways in this area of, as Rory put it, taking these questions much more to a much deeper place. And we will, the Institute will continue to do that. Thank you, speakers. Thank you.